Hello and welcome to Law Pod. I am Dr. Lauren Dempster. I'm a senior lecturer here in the School of Law at Queen's University Belfast, and I'm director of Law Pod. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Nisan Aliche. Nisan, could you introduce yourself for us?
Yes, thank you very much for having me here, Lauren. My name is Nisan Aliche. I started here at Queen's in the beginning of October, so it's been 2 months. And I'm here for a one-year postdoc fellowship, which is the ESRC 9DTP fellowship. It aims at building up on my PhD research and working more on the outputs of that research.
Thanks, Nisan. I'll come back to your postdoc in a couple of questions time, but to begin, could you tell us a bit about your PhD research and in particular, what brought you to the topic of your PhD in the first place?
Sure. So my PhD was about transitional justice in Turkey's ongoing Kurdish conflict. And I started developing interest in the issue when I finished my first degree and when I started working in the Turkish parliament. And at the time, we had a peace process going on. So all these issues of transitional justice, dealing with the past and peace building in more general terms, they were quite vibrant at the time, and there were a lot of discussions, and also in the academic world in Turkey as well, there were a lot of studies being done. And the civil society was very actively involved in all these discussions, and that's when I started getting really interested in the topic. Then the peace process collapsed in Turkey, but I thought maybe transitional justice could still be relevant for what civil society actors, especially the victim organizations and victims groups, are doing. So I wanted to look into how we can use transitional justice in an ongoing conflict, and Turkey's Kurdish conflict was my case study. And while looking at that, I was also trying to understand whether grassroots organizations, victims' movements, and specifically the relatives of the disappeared in Turkey could contribute to achieving transitional justice goals when there is an ongoing conflict. In our case in Turkey, the situation is even more complex because it's not just an ongoing conflict, but there is also an increasingly authoritarian regime, which started to get even worse after the collapse of our peace process in 2015. So I was trying to look into that context of the intersection of ongoing conflict, armed conflict, and authoritarian regime. And I focused specifically on Saturday mothers, Saturday people, as we call them, like both of them are used by the movement and by wider society. I was looking into their activities, their motivations, their goals, and how they see the transitional justice prospects in Turkey.
Great. Thanks, Nisan. I want to pick up on the context of increasing authoritarianism in Turkey. And obviously here in the UK, we're seeing pushback in terms of freedom of expression, the right to protest, these kind of things. Could you tell us a bit about how the authoritarian regime, how that shaped the efforts of the Saturday mothers or the Saturday people to mobilize and to campaign?
So firstly, it is true, as you said, it's happening here in the UK, but it's also happening globally. We know that authoritarian regimes are on the rise, and that's also why I think this is very relevant to look into transitional justice, like the potential of transitional justice for authoritarian regimes as well. And when we think about what's happening in different parts of the world. And when it comes to Turkey and specifically to the Saturday Mothers movement, when they started to mobilize, it was in the middle of the 1990s. So the armed conflict was at its peak. The violence was really high all over Turkey, but mainly in the Kurdish region and against the Kurdish population. There was already not a favorable political atmosphere for them, but they kept getting larger in terms of the numbers of participants and the members that they got involved in the movement, even in those adverse conditions. But after the collapse of the peace process for civil society in general, the political and social space that were available to them before, it wasn't there anymore. It was even harder to go on the streets to organize their weekly gatherings as they did for many years on Saturdays in Galatasaray Square, which is the most centrally located square in Istanbul. Their gatherings were banned by the mayor of Istanbul. So they decided to switch the location to a different place, which is still close to their regular gathering place, but it's not exactly the same. And that undermines the symbolic value of their gatherings as well. They don't reach out to as many people as they used to, but they still insisted on getting together every Saturday until they got back their usual gathering place. And it finally happened 2 weeks ago, they are now able to go back to Galatasaray Square. But until it was possible, for many months, they were beaten by police. They were taken into custody every Saturday. So this, of course, impacted their reach as well in terms of how many people are encountering their sit-ins, their gatherings. They are all very different now compared to how they were before and before the peace process, for example.
Thanks, Nisan. So what prompted their being allowed to return to Galatasaray Square?
That's a good question, and we don't have an answer to that. One potential response would be about the upcoming local elections. So there might be some tactical changes in the government's response to what civil society and the Kurdish politicians are doing now, but we don't have a logical answer, really. Like, it's hard to tell what made this change possible, because until then, they were very brutally repressed and they faced police violence every Saturday without exceptions. But there were lots of international responses as well, like the calls from Amnesty International and many other international human rights NGOs. But this could have worked earlier, but they didn't. So why did it happen now? We don't have an answer, really. But usually these type of sudden changes in government's response to civil society movement, they usually have to do with some pragmatic interests. So that's why people think it might be related to the upcoming local elections.
Thanks, Nisan. I'm going to move on to your postdoc in a second, but I wanted to pick up on one more aspect, I guess, of your PhD research. So obviously, as you said, you were looking at transitional justice in the context of ongoing conflict. So what were kind of your key findings in that area?
I think I can start by saying that I was much more hopeful when I started the research. And whenever I finished the thesis, the whole research, I was a bit disappointed and sad about my findings. But they all make sense. But I think when I first started, the authoritarian regime wasn't as consolidated yet. So probably it also has to do with the fact that I was a lot more hopeful. There were a lot more discussions still about peace and transitional justice. But over the years, they all gradually faded away. But one of my key findings is that even during an ongoing conflict, organized victims' movements have a great potential to achieve transitional justice goals, at least to some extent. So they might not be able to, for example, establish an official truth commission, because you do have to engage the state or governmental bodies for that. But you might still get a lot of progress in terms of memorialization, truth seeking, truth recovery, or accountability. So you can be able to initiate at least a lot of official processes as well if you have a very well organized and sustainable social movement, which is coming from a victim's movement. But I think maybe a more interesting finding is that it is something to try to engage in transitional justice when there is an ongoing conflict, but it is completely a different thing when you are trying to do that with an additional challenge of resisting an authoritarian regime. And I think that's what happened in Turkey, and I can see it more clearly now, because apart from those 2 years where we had a peace process between 2013 and 15, there was an ongoing conflict for decades anyway. And still, civil society had a lot wider space to engage in these issues, and they were able to gather some public responses as well. So wider society would show more interest as a response to civil society's efforts in dealing with the past. But because now the civic space in general is very limited, it's still there and people are still doing a lot of important work, but their impact is limited, unfortunately. And that changed a lot of things when it comes to how civil society or victims groups can do in terms of transitional justice. So unfortunately, the space, the political and social space that's available to us is quite limited.
Thanks, Nisan. To bring us then, I guess, to where you are now, obviously you mentioned you're here at Queen's now doing a postdoc. Could you tell us how that relates to your builds on your thesis and what that postdoc focuses on?
Yeah, so this postdoc is just a 1 year research, and the main idea is to not start a completely new research. So I think it was just 10% of new research that you can add to this 1 year fellowship. The main goal, I would say, is to increase the practical and also academic impact of your PhD research. And that's why I was really keen on doing this fellowship this year, because I did want to have some space to write a book out of this thesis, for example, but also to have more space and opportunities to engage practitioners in an opportunity to discuss the findings of my research. One thing I'm planning this year in May, hopefully, is a roundtable with practitioners and scholars from Northern Ireland and Turkey so that they can come together and they can talk about how these two cases can learn from each other. And my PhD findings will inform those discussions. It will be the starting point. And as this additional new research component, I'm looking into the civil societies and victims groups' role in transitional justice in Northern Ireland. So I'm hoping that this will also create or facilitate some joint collaborative discussions and knowledge exchange between the two countries, but especially engaging more practitioners in these discussions. And I will also organize some workshops and training modules in Turkey, again with practitioners. And these practitioners, some of them at least, are the same people whom I interviewed for my PhD. So there will be some long-term continuity in terms of how these research findings still make sense or not, and how I can develop further research projects based on what's happening on the ground right now.
Thanks, Nisan. I wanted to ask you about the process of getting your fellowship. So I guess for anyone listening who's maybe recently completed a PhD or is in their final stages, could you tell us a bit about what the process was like generally? And I mean, you've alluded to this already, but why perhaps you wanted to apply to the fellowship program that you did, which is the ESRC 9 DTP scheme?
So I finished my PhD in June 2022. And you were my external examiner. That's how we initially met each other. And last year, after I was working as a research assistant for Nottingham Trent University, and I was also a visiting scholar at Cambridge. So I was working on different research projects, which were all super interesting and very helpful for my research development. But I wanted to, and I needed to have some more space, first to write the book, but also, again, to reflect more on my research findings, because PhD is just a few years, but you are trying to fit a lot of practical, empirical, and theoretical work into one piece of work. But I felt the need to have more space to engage, both theoretically engage more with my thesis, but also to talk to people more about it and to see how I can take it forward. And I think doing this research in Northern Ireland is a part of it, for example. So I always knew, I think, about the ESRC postdoc fellowship, at least since when I was probably halfway through my PhD research. And that was something I kept in mind. And then last year, I wanted to apply for the fellowship. And I was thinking whether to continue at Ulster, that's where I did my PhD at Transitional Justice Institute, or continue with Queen's. And it was a hard decision because I was at Ulster and I felt very connected to there, but I also knew that it was a good decision to do some research in a different institute. And of course, Queen's has a really great and large network of transitional justice scholars, so that was a big appeal. And also the fact that you were here and I approached you as a potential mentor and you said yes, and so that was great. That's how I applied. And I think for me, it was important to publish the book, for example, and I already had the book contract with Routledge at the time, so I knew I needed to write the book. I just need to have some more space and time. But I think for me, the most interesting, most attractive part is there's a big focus on practical and policy impact in this fellowship. And I really care about that part, because whenever I started doing this research, I really wanted it to be useful and relevant for whoever is using transitional justice framework in Turkey, for example. That's my main area of interest, of course. So I saw this as a great potential for me to get together with civil society representatives from Turkey. And I'm also hoping that this will lead to a longer term research project with more insights from practitioners from Turkey and also Northern Ireland.
Thanks, Nisan. And yeah, I'm delighted to be your mentor. So thank you for including me in your project. By way of rounding up, not to put you on the spot, but would you have any kind of tips or advice for people who are thinking about applying for postdocs, or, you know, thinking about next steps at the end of their PhD?
Maybe I can say they might try to take time. And I know it's difficult because you always feel the pressure that you are your PhD scholarship maybe is running out and you need to find, you need to make sure about your next steps. And as in my case, there are visa issues sometimes involved as well. So you are not in a position, I know, of just taking your time and try to see how it will go. But I think it's still important to try to minimize that feeling of just panicking and stressing out about the next steps and just jump into a new opportunity. If research is what you want to do for another while, I think a postdoc is a great opportunity. Without getting involved too much in teaching yet, I think it's a luxury to have some months. And 1 year is not too long, but it's still an important period of time that you can devote some quality time to your research. So I think it's important to just think a little bit about what you want to focus on more. Is it research? Is it teaching? Is it both of them? And then try to take the next steps accordingly.
Yeah, but I think it's important to note like the aspiration of trying to, as you say, distance yourself a little bit from that feeling of panic and thinking about what's best for you. So thank you, Nisan, for joining us. I know you are working on some publications from your research currently, so we'll signpost those in the show notes for our listeners if they want to read more about your work. And yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak to LawPod today.
Thank you very much.